Accession number 10170, reel number 2.
Mr. Walter Spencer, reel 2. Which platoon and company were you assigned to when you arrived at Chelsea?
When I got to Chelsea, it was actually consisted of what was known as the 5th or Reserve Battalion Grenadier Guards. But later, after we'd been there about 3 weeks, the 4th Battalion was formed, and I was a member of the 4th Battalion, and in the 16th Platoon, there were four companies to a battalion and four platoons to a company. So I was number 16. That was the last platoon, as you might say, in the battalion. And our training mainly there was, of course, for a start, on guard mounting.
What did guard mounting training entail? What did it involve?
Well, chiefly in marching up and down, paying salutes with a rifle, that's bringing the rifle down in front, you know, to salute an officer, and sentry box general duties, same that we would be performing on Royal Guard. That'd be up and down. You'd learn to be a single sentry or a double sentry. If you were double sentries, you worked absolutely together, identically together, by going. One would turn to the left, and the other would turn to the right, you see, and march, say, 20 paces, turn about together, and come in together again, and then go back into your box. We did quite a lot of that, but after we got professional at that, we were very soon into real guard mounting.
Did you find the drill difficult to learn?
No, not really. It was quite simple. Once... When he'd done it about two or three times, you'd got it all off. And, of course, there were a lot of ceremony attached to it from the marching point of view, because the regimental band used to march you up from Chelsea up to either Buckingham Palace or to St. James's Palace, wherever you were delegated. Anyhow, I was delegated to go on... One Monday morning, they always put it on orders when it was for guard mounting and which particular guard you were for. You'd assemble on the barrack ground at Chelsea about 9:30 a.m. and the whole regimental band would be there and numerous officers, and there'd be four contingents on parade. There'd be the King's Guard, that was Buckingham Palace Guard on the front. The next guard would be St. James's Palace Guard behind them. The third was what they called the bank picket. They used to find a guard for the Bank of England. And the last guard was the Hyde Park Magazine Guard. They used to find a guard for Hyde Park, big magazine in Hyde Park. And when you'd become proficient... If you behaved yourself, you'd go on guard. But if you'd made any mistake or any bloomers, you'd be soon delegated back to the ranks, and someone else would take your place on the guard. Invariably, you'd do one King's Guard at Buckingham Palace on the Monday morning, 10 a.m., you'd go on mount, and then you'd be on duty there until 10 a.m. the next morning, Tuesday morning, when you'd be relieved. You'd go back to Chelsea Barracks, and then you had no duties to do at all. You were quite free to go out from barracks, provided you had no punishment parades or anything like that to attend. And then your next guard would be on St. James at Wednesday morning. You'd come off on Thursday morning at 10 o'clock. Then you do the same, no more work to do at barracks until Friday. You went on to the Hyde Park Magazine Guard and came off Saturday morning. Saturday morning, when you came off, you made a beeline for the adjutant's office and had to apply for leave, for weekend leave, you see. The officer would either grant it or refuse it, and if he granted it, you'd get a warrant to proceed from from London to wherever you wanted to go. I'd want London to Nottingham, invariably. I'd come to Nottingham for the weekend, and then back again Sunday night to barracks.
Could we just take one of those, to Buckingham Palace one, I think you remember better. What did you actually do during that 24 hours? What was the procedure of a guard?
Well, if you were detailed, you were all detailed for number one, two or three or four or five or six, or six posts, actually, at Buckingham Palace that you had to cover, and you'd be detailed for your post, and then you'd be detailed for the time you had to go on. If you were the first sentry on guard, you'd go on from 10 till 12. You'd be relieved at 12, and then you had 4 hours clear until 4 o'clock. Then you'd do 2 hours from 4 till 6, then another four-hour gap, and so you went on right till next morning until you were relieved. That's 2 hours on and 4 hours off.
What about the ceremonial of taking the regimental colours in and such like?
Oh, well, that is all done. That's in what they call trooping the colour. That's all done when the guard is being changed. Have you seen the ceremony, by the way? When the guard is changed, the old guard marches up and the new guard is one side all ready to go away and then to take our place, the new guard is on one side, I should say, and the other is on the other side of the square, and they troop the colour there, and after they've played the regimental march and one or two more things, they go round and leave all the old sentries who fall into their places and put the new sentries in their place.
Are there any incidents or you remember from guard duty at any of the four guard places that you could be put on?
No, I never remember anything very exceptional. I used to rather enjoy guard duty because it was a bit of a respite from barrack work, see.
What about the public? Did you see much of the public while you were on this?
Well, not a great deal because although we were outside the rails then instead of inside, they're always inside now, aren't they? Well, we used to have sentry boxes outside and you'd either wear double sentry on the front or single sentries around one of the garden posts or around by the stables and that kind of thing, where the various posts were.
Now, you'd obviously been issued your uniforms now. Can we just cover that? What uniforms were you issued with?
We were issued with khaki. Ordinary khaki. That was all done at Chelsea Barracks very soon after we got up there. Not immediately, but I think within a fortnight of when we arrived at Chelsea, we got all our kit, necessary kit. We as a battalion, that's the 4th Battalion, which had been formed out of the recruits who were coming along each month, we'll say, from Caterham. We were formed as a battalion in 1915, about June. And from there...
How did you get your uniform in a condition suitable for the Royal Guards? I mean, you must have had it very smart. How did you go about that?
Oh, yes. We had to stay in at night and clean your buttons and your buff and all that kind of thing, all ready for next morning, you see. You know, everything, if you were detailed, you know the day before that you were going to go on guard, so you wouldn't go out that night. You'd have to get to work with your, what they call the soldier's friend, and clean your buttons, and everything had to look... of its best. If it wasn't shining, you lost your name because you got a dirty rifle or dirty buttons or anything like that, you'd be finished on the King's Guard and you'd be relegated again back to your old mob, you see.
Were there any tricks of the trade for getting a special shine that was suitable?
No, I think it's just a matter of common sense. Of course, some chaps didn't bother much about getting shone up and of course, they wouldn't last very long on Royal Guard, but I always used to like to turn out spick and span and not what we call lose my name. Of course, there were all kinds of punishment parades, too, for anybody who didn't shine up. They'd not only be dismissed from the Guard, they'd probably get two or three extra drills when they had to march round the square in pack order for an hour.
You'd been issued with your rifle. Did you get your rifle training while you were at Chelsea?
Did we get it?
Your rifle training while you were at Chelsea. You'd been issued with a rifle, you said.
Oh, yes, yes. We had training. There were inside butts there. We used to go and fire there, but we didn't get much fire in practice. I was rather surprised at that. We got more, ordinary PT and drill movement than we did with doing much with rifle. We used to go down occasionally to Purbright. Purbright was our rifle range, and shoot what we call a fire your course. When you were proficient at firing the early Enfield, you'd fired your course, and if you're a good shot, you used to be able to wear the old cross guns on your sleeve, which carried a penny a day extra. So it was worth getting if you could. I never did get it, but I passed out firing the course anyhow.
What did they concentrate on teaching you? Accuracy or speed of fire or what?
Well, speed of fire was one element, and the next, of course, was accuracy with the target. They used to put the target up, and then each man had a target to fire at, and when he'd finished, when that line had finished firing, all the targets were reviewed, you see, by the sergeant in charge, and he'd count out the number of points you got. He'd award you points, you see, on your target.
What about now you've got your rifles and bayonets? Did you have any practice in bayonet drill?
Well, a little. We used to have fixing bayonets and unfixing them, but that was quite a simple matter, really. The only thing was keeping in time. When they got the command fixed bayonets, you see, one chap, the number one of the front rank, would take two paces forward, and all the remainder of the squad would watch him, and every time he moved his arm to get hold of the bayonet to fix it, you do kind of one, two, three, you see, together. That's all there was in fixing bayonets.
What about any training in bayonet fighting? Did they have any of that?
Very little. We used to do that on the front of the barracks, between the road and the barracks. They had a kind of a training course there, and they had a number of sacks, stuffed sacks hung up, you know, like on swing posts, and you had to charge at those, but it was very elementary, and nobody ever took it very seriously, I don't think.
What about, were you given any training at all in anything to do with trench warfare, trench digging, or...
Yes, a little. In nearly the last week, I think, we were in Chelsea, we went to a place named Brasted, Brasted, in Kent. It was very near to the coast, actually, and we used to go down there by train for a whole week, digging trenches, and received instruction how to dig them and the pattern of the trench, you see. And it was all closed off down there. I remember we used to come home sludged up, you know, and had to get cleaned up for next morning's parade.
We talked about wiring, and we talked about wiring, barbed wiring.
No, we didn't do any wiring. You see, wiring was really a job for either a pioneer battalion or the Royal Engineers. They didn't bother us at all with wiring. We never touched wire before. We didn't see wire, as a matter of fact, until we got to France. Saw a few miles of it there.
Did you have any more tactical exercises? You told me about how at Caterham you used to practice extended Boer War type tactics. Did you get any more relevant tactics?
No more of that. It was nearly all foot drill at Chelsea and guard mounting.
What did you think of your training? By the time you got to the end of Chelsea, before you went to Marlow, what did you think you'd been fully trained? Were you satisfied that you were ready for war at the time?
Oh yes, I think so. And by the way, we used to have several times, perhaps once a fortnight, we'd have marched around London, you know, different parts of London, Battersea Park and that end, just to get used to forming fours and marching in fours.
How did the civilians react in London?
Oh, yes, they used to like to see us. Used to get all the servant girls to the window to see us come by. Joyce. Population. But, of course, they used to be very interested in seeing the guard mounting both on the way there and on the way back, and we were at the palace. It always used to draw a big crowd.
What machine gun were you trained in, and what were you trained?
Well, chiefly in the Vickers Maxim gun. We spent quite a long time, most weeks on the Vickers Maxim when we were down at Marlow. We went to Camp Marlow in after the battalion was formed on in June at Chelsea, and we were at a place called the Park, and it was owned by General Higginson, who was an ex-Grenadier Guard officer.
So before you'd gone to Marlow, you were still the 5th Battalion, were you? Or?
No, until the 4th Battalion was actually formed in the Reserve Battalion's place at Chelsea, you see. We were formed on Chelsea Barrack Square, and the Welsh Guards were also formed there.
And what month would that be?
In June 1915.
So you'd been there about 5 months before that happened?
That's right, yes.
So, and you were the 5th Battalion before then?
Yes, everybody was 5th. That was the Reserve Battalion, you see. But when they got so many up there to make another battalion, it was the Regular Battalion.
So you became the 4th and were sent to Marlow. What happened at Marlow when you got there?
We were under canvas at Marlow. We stayed at Marlow until we went to France. And it was nearly all field training, mostly out there with full kit, you see. We had a full rifle and bayonet and webbing and khaki and all that kind of thing. This place at Marlow was a lovely park, and it was owned by General Hodgkinson, who had been a Grenadier Guard himself. And we used to do very well down at Marlow because we'd get out each night into the town, you see, and it was quite a nice, enjoyable town. And there was, I remember, there was one cinema there, but it was a job to get in there if you didn't go there early.
What sort of things would you do when you went into town in London and in Marlow? Was it cinemas you were mainly interested in, or what? Or did you go to the pubs, or what?
Well, we used to have... do you mean in the leisure time, or...?
No, while you were training.
In the training. Some of the field movements that we used to do on the common at Caterham were repeated at Marlow, you see, in full kit. We hadn't got a kit when we were at Caterham, you see. To do that was a haversack and water bottle and trenching tool and a full pack. But we used to get used to that when we got to Marlow, because we got it all then, you see.
Were you training just as a battalion or as a larger unit?
Mostly as a battalion, yeah. But different companies did have different schedules there, you see, but generally it was to get all the battalion used to field conditions abroad.
What did you think of your NCOs at the time?
The NCOs were very, very decent, provided you behaved yourself. You're all right all through the army, so long as you did as you're told. And if you didn't do as you're told, well, you'd very soon get into trouble. That was the whole crux of the matter. I never got into any serious trouble at all, the little minor offences I might have committed, but I never asked for trouble.
What was the attitude of the NCOs like? Was it friendly or distant or...?
Well, it was friendly up to a point, but they weren't allowed to mix, you see, with the privates. If you were promoted to corporal, you cut off all acquaintance with the old pals who were privates, you see, because he had to instill a bit of discipline. His word was it.
What about the officers? How did you get on with them?
Well, the officers, of course, were fairly aloof from us. We didn't see much of them except when it's on either a big ceremonial occasion or some important occasion.
Did you have any opinions about them, or were they too distant for you to even...
Yes, well, of course, especially later on...
I mean, really, before you went to war.
No, we didn't... The only officers we really saw was our own company commanders and our platoon officers during the time we were in training, and they used to come and join the company for a route march or anything like that. He'd head his the various platoons or companies, you see. And they were quite all right. Mostly men, of course, from colleges, as Sandus and that kind of thing. And really, they were, I should say, very intellectual men. We used to men look up to them and respect them because they had superior knowledge to us regarding things military. They'd been taught in a different school.
How, this was your first period in the army. How were you settling in with the army lifestyle and the lack of privacy, things like that? Did it bother you at all, or how did you find the army lifestyle up to now?
Oh, I found it very decent. I was quite, I won't say I was altogether satisfied, but I was happy, you know what I mean? And as the conditions as they were, I thought I did very well.
Did you mind the lack of privacy? Did you mind the lack of privacy?
Oh, no. No, you soon got used to that. There was nothing in it, really. You got used to seeing one another naked, and that was it.
Right, you were at Marlow until the battalion was actually posted overseas. That would be on August 15th, 1915.
That's correct.
Were you given any warning that you were going overseas?
No,
or any embarkation leave?
Not the slightest, but we had an idea by the way they were working up with different things that we should be soon going. As a matter of fact, we were all very pleased to know that we were going. We kind of welcomed the news that we were actually going over. We would know the day before we went, actually. We went over on August the 15th, was on a Sunday, and we went from Marlow about midday and went to Southampton.
Were you given any sort of send-off by civilians or anybody?
No, it was kept fairly quiet. I think they didn't want it to be too public that we were going, you see. They'd probably not, Marlow, when they saw us march out as a battalion on Sunday, because that was an unusual day, you see, for the troops to be doing anything in the way of marching.
So you went via Southampton. Can you tell me about the crossing? Could you tell me about the crossing?
Yes, the crossing. We embarked about, as far as I can say, about 10 o'clock at night. It was a night crossing. They intentionally kept us back, I think, because of the U-boats, you see, so that we went under cover of darkness. The crossing was made on an old Isle of Man paddle steamer, and it was very, very rough. And I should think 75% of the battalion was seasick on the way over.
Did that include you?
No, I wasn't seasick at all. Never been seasick in my life. I've been thousands of miles on the sea, but I wasn't seasick even on the old Isle of Man paddle steamer. We arrived in Le Havre at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and we got off the boat there, and we went from there to Saint-Omer. That was the first place that we marched to from Le Havre.
Now, you knew you were going into action eventually. What had you heard about the Western Front and the type of fighting on there? Did you know what was going on the Western Front, the sort of fighting you were about to face?
Well, yes, we had a good idea. We were given lectures, of course, when we got out there about the different things, including, for one thing, water, what we could drink and what we could eat when we were in France. And we weren't allowed to touch any of their water. In case it was contaminated, all the water we got came from our own water carts, and it had already been chlorinated, you see, and the MO sort of that part of the business, so that we didn't come up against any of these wells and pumps which were all suspect in France.
That's what you'd been warned of before you got there?
Yes.
So what were you doing at Saint-Omer? How long did you stay there?
Well, actually, we weren't in Saint-Omer. We were about two or three kilometres out south of Saint-Omer, at a little place called Blondec, Blendiques, a very nice little village, and we were billeted there mainly in farms, in barns from farms, you know, very big barns. They used to go and requisition them and put the troops in them. and a farmer, I understand, got a penny per man per night while you were billeted in his barn.
Now, it was while you were there, I think, that the Guards Division was formed.
Yes, the Guards Division were formed. Our 1st Battalion had already been out there, of course, some time, and they were at a place called Wizerns, which was about a couple of miles away from Blondeck, two little villages. And actually, the Guards Division was formed between Wizerns and Blondeck. It consisted of the four battalions of Grenadiers, four battalions of Coldstreams, two of Scots, one Irish and one Welsh regiment. That was the whole Guards Division. And the fourth Coldstreams were made into what they call a pioneer battalion. Their main job when we got up the line was digging trenches for latrines and all that kind of thing. All the rough work and road repair and that.
What were you doing at Blondeek during this period while the division was being formed in the area?
Well, we did pretty much the same. We did company drill and battalion drill and went for route marches to kind of keep fit or to have exercise, we'll say. And it was quite a novelty to us to be in France.
Now, you left Blondeek. Where did you go from there?
We went from there up to a place called Sailly-le-Bourse.
And that would be round about the 29th?
Yes, somewhere about then, yes. Which was quite a long march, I can remember. It was a good day's march that day.
And if you could then tell us what happened in the days immediately preceding the Loos attack, as far as you remember them.
Preceding?
The action at Loos.
You
were at Sailly-le-Bourse?
Yes, we were at Sailly-le-Bourse. We had, I think, about 2 or 3 days there, if I can remember rightly. Not very long. It's only a matter of getting rested, I think, before we went actually into the line. And when we moved from there, we went to a place called Vermels. And Vermels was the first village we'd seen in which had been shattered by German gunfire. It was a mining village, really. I think a place of perhaps ordinarily of about 2,000 or 3,000 population. We stayed there, I think it was 2 nights we stayed there, before we finally went up to the firing line. Vermels, of course, wasn't far behind the line as it was then, because the German line, when we went to Vermels, was I should say perhaps a mile and a half to the west of the village, and their artillery had played havoc with. There was no population, by the way. All the inhabitants had left Vermels.
So you were there round about the 26th.
That's
of
right.
September.
Yes.
And on the 27th, you left to go into Loos.
That's right.
Did you know? Were you briefed at all about the operation?
Well, we.
Briefed at all about what was to happen? Did anyone tell you what was happening?
Well, the CO had, we had a battalion meeting at Vermels, and the CO told us what the attack was, where the attack was to be made, and what we were expected to do, and what we were hoped to take, you see. He gave us a brief survey. Our objective there, of course, was mopping up in Loos, which had already been strongly attacked, and trying to get a foothold on Hill 70, which was just beyond Loos, because, you see, again, Jerry was holding all the high ground there, and the high ground of the machine gunners was so useful to pick us off as we came along.
What was the situation? This is the first time you'd been near the front line. What impression did you have as you approached the line?
Well, I wasn't very thrilled, because on our way between Vermels and Loos, there'd been a Highland Brigade in action about a half a mile away, I say, from Vermels, and there were a lot of dead Highlanders still hanging on the wire. against what had been the old German wire, you see. That was the old German trench where they'd first been evacuated from. When we got into Lewes, we went up the main street and got among the cellars and threw a few Mills bombs about in case there were any Germans round. And